Eric wanted to make a comment. Go ahead, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Yeah, K2RIW, K2J. A number of years ago, now most people don't realize that we replied our devices in broadcast videotape recorded where we actually control the height of the head. Using the Pizo device through the interesting servo system. But there were a bunch of guys at MIT a couple years ago, and what they had done was taken a few of these types of layered Pizo devices and placed them inside Snickers. And they used that to create a battery charger system for cell phones. There's a couple of patents on it now, and the company in, I'm not sure whether it was South Korea or Taiwan that was working on making a commercial product out of it. But I had, in the early 80s, late 70s, we had taken, when I was working for the computer graphics lab, I had taken these Pizo devices and used them as shock sensors for making some musical instruments, so that you put those things in a source of vibration, where one of the guys actually put it in a wind tunnel with a set of vanes, so it would, this thing, like a reed, as the wind would go by, it would generate power. K2RIW, K2J.
Those piezo devices that you were putting on a musical instrument to pick up the sound, would you call that an accelerometer? Was that the method by which it was working, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, you could call it that. Not really an accelerometer, more like a shock sensor. They were used for, now they're actually being manufactured all the time, as you see these electronic drum sets. They basically have a little piece of piezo in there that's attached to the drum pad. Depending upon how hard you hit the drum pad, it produces an output. And it's also voltage and duration. So when you go and you buy an electronic drum set, and even on some of these drum machines, you have these little pads that you can pound with your fingers. Those are also piezo devices.
Interesting. I know we got a little bit off of subject, but I think it requires a cyclic vibration to continuously get power out of a piezo device, and quite possibly the email you received, Mel, is advocating that. Some kind of a vibrating reed in the wind is a possible guess. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, I guess he's developing something like that. I said, well, I really tell you, I didn't want to make much comment, but I said I would just bring the subject up briefly. The word piezo is from the Greek. A lot of people think it's Italian, but it is Greek, as putting my idea. My daughter just called on the phone. And it is pronounced piezo, actually, in Greek, piezo. Anyhow, make a long story short, just that demonstration of it would be a phonograph cartridge, over.
A large number of phonograph cartridges in the days of ordinary LP records, or 45 records, or 78 RPM records, were piezo, we'll call it, cartridge, where the shake of the needle as it went down the groove was picked up by the cartridge, and that produced the voltage that gave you the music, and they worked very well. You get a slightly higher fidelity magnetic pickup type cartridge, but they're a lot more expensive, and it gives you a much, much smaller signal and requires a lot more amplification, and getting extremely low noise audio amplification with the transistors that were available in those days was not easy. You had to work pretty hard at it. So the inexpensive phonograph records players, piezo, that effect was the way they worked. Why don't you go on to the next one if you want, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Okay, just one final word, as my daughter said, so I'll give her her claim to fame. She says it actually means when she studied this in her studies at NYU when she started out doing her engineering, really, and all. She said it was really the study of, I wrote it down, the study of chemical reactions under the influences of high pressures. That's called the piezochemistry. All right, anyhow, let's see. Let that go. Hold on, let me look here. I think I got one here of interest. Did you want to say something first? Over.
I don't think so. I'm waiting for your next question from the mailbag, Mel. And have we had any more of those very pleasing letters that we get periodically where someone says, I heard you guys on the TechNet. You seem to be having a lot of fun educating each other. I decided to go out and get a ham radio license, and boy, am I glad I did that. Back to you, Mel. I think we occasionally get one of those letters, and they're very pleasing. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Well, got a number of always emails thanking us for, you know, the number of things that we discussed, especially, like I say, young people seem to be the ones that are producing the most of the question emails. So I try to boil it down to a subject. And the one subject I see here, we discussed this. No, I'm looking for something that... Okay, here, you know, oh, about homebrewing. We started that last week, you know, about making things, kits, and things like that. And they would like to do some small assembly of electronic circuits. And what has been your experience about and method of making a printed circuit? You know, this is a question on homebrewing that comes up many times, whether to go through the procedures of making, you know, a printed circuit for a one shot, or to do point-to-point wiring, you know, vector boards, whatever. What are you, have you done any homebrewing, making your own PC boards, or how would you go about making a small project? You know, how would you say wiring, not the days of chassis? Don't tell me to get out the Greenleaf punching stick. Go ahead.
From time to time on the TechNet, we've discussed homebrewing printed circuit boards. Quite a number of guys who have signed in and give us the results of their experiments were relatively successful by making printed circuit boards with a quasi a photographic-like process. In other words, taking raw printed circuit, you know, copper-clad fiberglass material and putting the right kind of a resist on there by one means or another, a Xerox machine or whatever, creating an exposure, and then putting the whole printed circuit board, after developing the surface material, putting it into the right kind of developing material, which becomes the resist, and put it into the chemistry. The chemistry itself is a somewhat toxic process, and what do you do with the waste chemistry? It's a pretty big deal. If you're building yourself a whole lot of printed circuit boards and you want them all to be identical, that's a very desirable way to go. But most of the projects we build are onesie twosies, and I see another approach. Let me drop. To build a printed circuit board by taking copper tape and laying it on fiberglass sheets, thin sheets of material, that's one way. Starting off with copper-clad material and cutting in the conductors and non-conductors with an X-Acto knife. And one of the things that's a skill set you can learn is that if you first cut through the copper with an X-Acto knife, and then there are certain places where you want to peel away the copper. Peeling away the copper from the fiberglass board is relatively difficult. The manufacturers try very hard to make sure that that copper is well stuck to the board. However, if you simply put a good bead of solder onto the portions of the copper clad that you want to remove, and you run your soldering iron down those portions of the copper clad board where the solder is, you run your soldering iron while the piece of copper is hot. You peel it first with an X-Acto knife and pick it up with your tweezers or your needle nose pliers. It's amazing how easy the copper clad will peel off of the board when there's solder on it to give you a good heat conduction between the iron, and you're heating that piece up with an iron. So when your printed circuit board is in a holding fixture like a vise, and you're heating up the places where you want to remove the copper, and you're doing a peeling process, by that technique you can very rapidly build printed circuit conductors and non-conductors side by side. I'll admit you're not going to build very fine details that way, unless you're willing to do it under a microscope. But at least it requires none of the chemistry, none of the exposure, none of the exotic materials that are toxic, and the disposal of these etching materials. The etching material process strikes me as a difficult way to go. So I have built in the last couple of weeks the equivalent of printed circuits by
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
By the hot soldering iron peeling process. You just hold the soldering iron against the copper and try peeling it. Unless you've got a pretty wide blade on the end of the soldering iron, it doesn't work very well. But if you put a pool of solder onto the portion of the copper clad you want to remove, and then run your soldering iron down it, down the pool of solder, which has a beautiful heat conducting between the iron and the whole area of that copper that you're trying to peel, that works very well. So there are multiple ways of making printed circuit boards. And if it's a onesie-twosie project, does it really have to be a printed circuit board? The fiberglass board you can buy with a whole bunch of holes in it called vector board that's on the bubble packs at Radio Shack, that with proper bus bar wiring through those holes, you can make the equivalent of a printed circuit board in a very rapid way. I'll admit that the disadvantage of the vector board approach is now you've got significant inductance of all those conductors because they're small in diameter, and if you've got a circuit that you want it to work well at 500 megacycles, that would be difficult. To make a vector board circuit work well at 3.5 megacycles with a good small layout, I think could definitely be done. So there are people who have really, by the chemical process, built printed circuit boards and take great pride in it, but there's a huge learning curve and a lot of toxic chemicals to be disposed of. And so think about all the steps of the process and make some decisions as to which way you want to go. That's a whole bunch of opinions on my part, but I bet you guys who have actually done it have probably a lot more optimistic opinions. Give me your call letters right now, K2RIW in the TechNet.
N2MB.
Barry is one of the guys who's built printed circuit boards. Anyone else? It looks like it's you, Barry. And when it comes back to you, Mel, you could use a little bit more audio, a little bit louder talking, or a little bit closer to the mic. But Barry, how many printed circuit boards have you built, and was there any difficulty with the chemicals and disposing of those chemicals? N2 Moonbounce, K2RIW in the TechNet.
There you go. Took long enough. I have another method which you can skip some of the chemicals because you're not using the light transfer process. What I used to do is I would take a pen and I would write right on the copper exactly where I wanted these things to go, you know, where the wires to be. And then if I wanted to make that a little better, they sell... it's like nail polish, basically, but it comes in... It almost looks like it's coming out of a pen, and I've seen that. And that nail polish is really easy to use if you want to make kind of fine lines. And you put that right on the board. You let it dry, just like regular nail polish, because that's what it is. And then you etch it. And that was very successful. I found that to be a good method because you could get mighty close to what the real thing was going to be with that.
But now, Barry, now describe the etching process. I think it's ferric chloride. I think it's a slightly toxic chemical that does the actual etching. How difficult, how expensive was it to get the etching solution, and what did you do to dispose of the used etching solution? Yeah, many a person will just pour it down the drain, but nowadays you really shouldn't do that because you're putting a toxic substance into the environment. Disposing of the etching solution, if you want to really follow the environmental protection rules, I think could be a little bit difficult. N2MB, K2RIW.
Okay, since you brought that up, it's been a while since I made those boards, and I have to confess, we weren't concerned with that at the time. I bought the stuff in Radio Shack, and I probably poured it down a drain. So I don't know what you do with the etching stuff. Maybe somebody real smart on this repeater will give us a good answer what we do with the etching stuff. But I, you know something, that etching stuff lasted so long, I don't remember it ever going bad. I kept using it and using it. I don't know. K2IW and 2MB. Okay, Georgia.
Once again, anyone who is hearing signals that you think shouldn't be there, please report them to Len, TQIBX, by way of the email address of rfi@limoc.org. rfi@limoc.org. If you tell us the time that you heard the signal, how strong was the signal, that's good information. You're listening on the input frequency, 146.25. Tell us what you've heard. And if you want to add to that, like what was the direction of arrival, that would all be very helpful. Go ahead, Eric, KE2EJ, K2RIW.
I'm reporting N2MB, N2MB, I found him.
All right, first of all, ferric chloride does get saturated, and it becomes ineffective as it becomes fully loaded. Ferric chloride really is supposed to be disposed of through an environmental organization that actually takes and keeps it and does a whole bunch of things to it. I don't use ferric chloride. I use a mixture of hydrogen peroxide, 50% hydrogen peroxide, and 25% sulfuric acid. And you never dispose of this stuff. You just keep adding more acid to it. And the copper precipitates out of it. And you can use a titration setup and actually control the process. And the stuff that I've etched with, it's been around for like about 6 years now, and I just keep replenishing it. So there's no environmental waste with it. But there's one method of doing PC boards that nobody's mentioned that we actually do when we have these low-power radio station get-togethers. And we get folks to build low-power FM transmitters. And what we actually do is take a piece of copper clad, knowing how to drop, and we cut little teeny squares of copper clad. And we glue them down to the big piece of copper clad, which is your ground plane. And we use these little pads as connection points, and you can, you know, do an ugly bug kind of construction with these little pads. It's a very interesting method of putting it together. If you're doing a one-shot thing and you're doing a circuit that's analog and not too complicated, it works out really well. K2RW, K2J.
Yeah, I've got one more way that I'm going to mention in a minute, but the sulfuric acid and the hydrogen peroxide, where did you buy those materials? Are they expensive? And what did you use as a resist? Were you using the nail polish-like resist on the printed circuit boards you made? And that does sound like a lot more friendly chemistry as far as a disposal is concerned. No real disposal required. It precipitates out in your solution. And I guess if you really cared, you could pour off the liquid and leave the precipitant in the bottom, and you've got almost fresh solution to proceed with and just add some more sulfuric acid, if I understand correctly. I'm guessing also the hydrogen peroxide slowly evaporates away, and maybe it's got to be replaced. So so tell us where you got the materials, and what were you using as a resist? Was it nail polish? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
All right, well, you've seen my boards here. They're real complicated. So I tend to make my PC boards in Eagle. From Eagle, I will create a list which runs on my mill. So my mill actually drills a hole. Then what I do is I take a Resus film and a laminator, and I run the Resus film through the laminator, which is exposed with either UV light or a fluorescent lamp. It's developed in a little bit of weak sodium hydroxide. Doesn't take much. And what I do actually, is I will actually, because I like to make plated through holes, what I do is I do an inverted mask. I then take this conductive ink and squeeze it through the holes and blow it out with air, which then leaves this conductive ink. This is ink with a little bit of silver in it. And it hits the top surface of the board and the bottom surface of the board. And then what I do is I will copper plate and then tin plate using this mask from this resist material. You can get the resist material from DigiKey, from Mauser, a few other companies. The etchant material that you use, by the way, this, if you tin plate the actual lens and the plated through holes that you've made, because you copper plate it first, it makes the copper a little thicker, and it also copper plates the through the holes, both top and bottom. We're talking double-sided copper board here. Then you tin plate it. The etchant doesn't affect the tin plating. So anywhere there's copper, the etchant will work. So it's really cool. That way you don't remove the plated through holes that you've just made.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You timed out for about 30 seconds, but I was hearing you beautifully on the input, so I'll repeat. He goes to a health food store to buy the hydrogen peroxide. He goes to a place where they take used car batteries, and there's where he gets the sulfuric acid. Also, you described a significant process by which you are creating plated through holes. I'm going to be asking you, Eric, because Mel's original question are from people just starting out in electronics. I think the learning curve to make these very professional printed circuit boards that you build in your laboratory is a fairly significant learning curve, quite a few procedures in there, and I don't think it's an easy way for us to tell them to go. In the case of a plated through hole, just simply sticking a piece of bus bar through there and soldering it on both sides, not as pretty looking, but that's one way of getting a plated through hole. I'll admit it's not the right kind where you can easily put a component through, but at least you can make contact between a land on top of the board and a land on the bottom of the board by putting in Z-bend pieces of metal and soldering those down. That's very effective, and I would have a little more trust in that.
People also use rivets.
Another very good approach, but my first question to you, Eric, is what do you believe is the approximate learning curve for the rather sophisticated process that you've just described? Do you think it's appropriate for Mel to describe this to a person just starting out in electronics? I think to learn all those steps and get the bugs out of them is something that before you go down that road, you want to find out how difficult will the travel be. KE2EJ for some opinions on that, and are there good books on this? K2RIW and the TechNet.
Yeah, Dick, also, when you put the components through the hole, if you simply solder it on both sides, it's pretty close.
If that's what you're using the hole for, the component lead going through there. Wait for the beeps, Eric, and is there a book on this, and do you recommend that Mel tell a beginning person to try to go, to try to perfect this process for onesie twosie boards? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Actually, it is. Yeah, well, look, I always electroplated parts, you know. I like to electroplate stuff, so that's one process. There is a company, I can't think of the name of it right now, that sells electroplating supplies. They sell the chemistry. They sell little pumps. The only thing they don't sell is a power supply to do your electroplating. So that's just one thing. Guys that are into, you know, making chrome parts for their motorcycles and stuff like that, they're already into it. That's easy. Although I don't like doing chrome because the chemistry there is really very toxic. Copper plating is not so bad, and tin plating is not so bad, so that's one aspect of it. And to do things simply, you can just take some nail polish and make your traces and off you go, but then again, how sophisticated are you going to do? You're going to do multi-legged parts. I mean, I'm into doing surface mount pieces. But the technique is not that hard. It's really not that difficult to accomplish. Single-sided boards done right with little jumpers on it can make, you can make fairly sophisticated circuitry without too much difficulty. There's a pre-program called Eagle. Eagle CAD. It's by CADsoft. It's type in the word Eagle. Free program, a schematic drawing program, and also PC layout program. Learn how to use that. Okay, from that, you can go right to a laser printer or an inkjet printer, and they sell these transfer pages, transfer sheets, which you print onto, and you literally iron that onto the copper board. Go etch and you're pretty much done. You have to drill the holes afterwards. Or you can drill the holes beforehand if you've got a CNC mill. Depending upon...
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out.
Oh, yeah. Blah, blah, blah.
All right. And then you can increase the level of complexity. There's a website that actually sells PC drills called Think and Think. Thinker and Thinker or Think and Think. Think and Think. And they actually have a manual on the website that describes the entire process, and they actually sell many of the materials if you want to get to that level of sophistication. K2RW, KE2EJ.
And KC2, QIQ with a comment.
Glenn recognized. I like the idea of the Dremel tool. If you're building onesie twosie, and once you develop a little bit of skill with a Dremel tool, you'd be amazed how easy it is to make slots in the copper where you've drawn it with a pen onto the copper clad board and cut away pieces in order to make the printed circuit board. You might want to do it under a microscope if you want it to really look pretty and you're making very fine lines, but that's a relatively simple process mechanically, and all of the fancy chemicals and etching and ironing and whatever are not required. All the ironing process can properly done with etching make a very professional looking board. Glenn, what have you done to build printed circuit boards, and how well did it work for you? Is there a good article describing it? Is it expensive? KC2QIQ, and were you at the Ham Radio University today? I wish I had run into you. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. And no, unfortunately, I was really trying to get out there today, but then unfortunately, I had a whole bunch of things I had to do and take care of first. And by that time, it was mostly over. It was a shame because I was really hoping to be there. But yeah, for doing very, very quick and dirty PC board, a lot of times when I'm making like a little EMI filter on a piece of copper clad, I use a Dremel, just like you suggested. And there's a nice little metal tool that's for the end of a Dremel that's got like a little bit at the end, and it's got a little grinding bit, very, very small. And you can make nice little trenches. And the only thing that I've done a little bit differently is I tend to do it with a wet and dry back handy. And the reason behind that is because I found a couple of times when I've made PC boards that way, it takes the dust out. This way, because when you're cutting that board with the Dremel, you have a lot of dust around. And if you've got the wet and dry back right next to the Dremel, you hold the wet and dry back in one hand with the little nozzle and just run the Dremel back and forth. It takes all the dust right out of the air. It works very, very nicely, Dick. Back to you. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Comment. I'll be over to comment in a minute. How many printed circuit boards have you built that way, Eric? And is there a bit of a learning curve? That's one of the questions Mel's going to be asking us is how much of is there a learning curve? Who taught you how to do that process, or was it something that Mr. Marchione invented on his own?
KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Well, the first time I actually tried it, I was in Germany, and we had a very, very long time, and I had to design an EMI filter and take some measurements on it. And they had a beautiful Dremel tool in Germany that they don't have here. It makes like a quarter the noise. One of the big disadvantages to the Dremel tool is the audible noise that comes from it. It's certainly something you want to do in the basement or the garage. I found out at the time that by using that tool and with a small vacuum, and they had these great little like little mini vacs over in Germany too. And when I got home, I was like, wow, what a great little way to make, you know, like little power boards. You know, it's not going to work with anything surface mount. When I go to surface mount, then I'll just, you know, go to one of the like the little local PCB suppliers and just basically give them a CAD DXF output and, you know, get something complicated that way. But for just little point-to-point wiring, I found that, you know, using a little Dremel tool and a little wet and dry vac and keeping the dust out works very, very well for little home projects and certainly for the beginner. I think that's a lot better than working with a lot of crazy chemicals and other things like that that are restricted, especially in Europe, never mind here. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Very fine. There's a man who's got a successful product. That's a process that works for him. A person who said comment, please give me your call letters, your name, and then proceed with your comment. I'm K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Thank you, Dick. This is Tim, N2RDB. I've spoken to you a few times before, and I'm a regular listener to the TechNet. I just wanted to throw in there that I've been doing stuff with strip line construction for a number of years now, at least a decade. At my job, we build passive LC filters, among several other things. And we actually buy the double-sided copper-clad board in these humongous sheets. And we send it to one of our sister companies, the machine shop. So we have them cut these little grooves in this copper-clad board. So we can lop off a piece of it with three strips on it. Now the underside we leave alone. And we take copper foil on each of the outer strips and wrap it around the edge of the board and solder it down. Now, that's the two ground planes. I'll let it drop for a moment. Now, along the center conductor, we make our little incisions and we can install our caps and coils, and that basically gets soldered inside the can. There are strips grounding it to the can itself, and we solder the living daylights out of it around the SMA connectors that we use. And we build on that. And that technique has proven to be good up to at least 1 gigahertz. And we can, you know, with the proper brass shielding between the sections, we can actually keep the keep our band rejection good out to 3 gigahertz minimum. Sometimes more than that, depending on the size of what we're working on. And, yes, I was at HRU today.
Dick? Okay. Who said Dick?
Yeah, K2J. Just put this out there. A good website that gives complete instructions on the PC board process of different methods. One, by the way, which we haven't mentioned, is by milling the PC board, which I've done a lot of that stuff with my CNC machine, but the thicknesses of the lands is restricted in terms of the accuracy of the CNC mill that you have. But the website is ThinkTink, www.thinktink.com. So that's thinktink.com. And they have, when you go from the homepage, you look at their PCB process, and it gives you the entire process both by doing milling and also artwork, etching, and even gives you instructions on how to do holes and, you know, through the holes and vias. So It's a good resource. K2RW, K2EJ.
Glad to hear that, Eric. So thinktink.com, thinktink.com gives you a lot of information. And some of the information that Tim just gave us is a lot more valuable than the first meets the eye. As you go to frequencies above, let me pick a number, 20 megacycles or so, when you lay out a printed circuit board, and if you're starting off with double-sided copper clad, and you've laid out your microstrip lines on the upper surface, and maybe you've made spaces around those lines so that the lines are, to some degree, a kind of transmission line called coplanar waveguide plus ground plane. The thing you've got to worry about is if your board is in any way double-sided. There are a number of times when the upper side of the board and the lower side of the board must be electrically connected to each other. By taking copper tape around the perimeter between the upper side and the lower side, a very narrow piece of copper tape, and soldering it along those edges so that the upper ground plane and the lower ground plane are equipotential. You'd be amazed how many times that can eliminate some very crazy performances of a circuit at VHF and UHF frequencies. Now let me drop. So when it comes to the degree of difficulty of doing troubleshooting on a board, that can help an awful lot. Also in strategic places, if you simply take a number 58 drill, a very small diameter drill, and drill holes between the upper and lower printed circuit board along a line, a whole series of holes, and put little pieces of bus bar, you know, 18 gauge, no shielding, no insulation wire between them, and make them into a Z-bend and solder them from top to bottom. These are poor man's plated through holes, so to speak. You add that to your circuit, and it can make an awful lot of performance improvement on the flatness of a filter, the flatness of an amplifier, and so on. So do worry about upper and lower ground plane being properly connected to each other, because on the raw board, they start off insulated. Particularly when you're working at UHF frequencies where I am, that can make a huge difference. I like the idea of directly etching the board. I like Glenn's idea of vacuuming up the dust. The workspace that I've got at the salt mine has got an awful lot of dust because I've been doing a lot of Dremel work on printed circuit boards as we speak, and to make certain kinds of modeling UHF antennas. And so my work area's got a lot of dust because I wasn't smart enough to use a vacuum where I was doing that. Anybody with any further comments on this before we pass it back to Mel as to how you have built printed circuit boards, give me your call letters right now. K2LAW in the TechNet.
N2RDB again.
Go right ahead, Tim.
Yes, I just wanted to add to that. Of course, we are using surface mount monolithic chip caps, you know, microwave caps, as it were, and we're using on the higher frequencies air coils, which really below 300 megs don't give you the proper result. So below 300 megs we use toroids, of course. And brass shielding between the sections keeps our rejection down. Anyway, I just thought I would pass that in. Yeah, I was at HRU today also. I feel it went fairly well. I spent most of my time at the Aries table. However, my wife, who is not yet a ham licensee, she came along and she attended some of the classes, and she was quite impressed. So, all in all, a good day. N2RDB, back to Nash.
Very good report, Tim, and thank you for that. The people who actually run Ham Radio University, KC2KY, among others, would certainly like to hear about that. Rich and quite a few of the other guys. Okay, so do think pretty hard about the shielding top to bottom. I mean, the making them equipotential surfaces. And yes, when you build a filter with surface-mounted components, inductors, capacitors, ceramic capacitors, little bitty
603-402 type surface mount inductors and capacitors. On your schematic diagram, you may think you've got a beautiful amplifier, a beautiful filter, and so on. RF energy likes to radiate. When it comes to building an antenna, that's good news. When it comes to building a printed circuit board, that which radiates from stage number one to stage number two can give you a lot of grief. So be willing to put brass or tin shields around each of your circuits, solder them down over top, build Quonset huts or whatever. Shielding the individual circuits from each other can make an awful lot of improvement. And I've been down that road a few times where the circuit really behaved improperly until the individual shields were put on, even though the whole circuit was, again, inside of an overall box. The shielding between the stages inside the box can be very important. Sometimes you've got to put absorbing material on the cover to make sure the cover is not reflecting signal from stage number one to stage number two, and or building shields the right way. There's quite an art form here to building modern-day circuits, but once learned, it's a valuable thing, a valuable skill to have, and people will pay you big money once you can build prototypes in that manner. And starting off as a ham radio operator and building them for yourself to develop the skill, and then eventually doing it for your
repeater. Timeout. Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
Develop that skill in your own shack, and then let your employer know that you have the ability to do that kind of prototyping. That can definitely increase your respect, your job security, your salary, your position, and so on. Maybe this is some of the information you're looking for, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, one more little thing about the MPC board.
Very good.
Let Barry say a couple words, and then Barry, you pass it directly over to Mel. Go ahead, Barry.
Okay, real good, yeah. There's another product that I forgot about because I haven't done it in a while, but they make a black plastic tape, very, very thin tape. You can get it in various widths, and you can even get it in component shapes, to mimic the bottom of a IC and stuff like that. And you simply put that on the board, and you with a backing nail, you push it down real good, and then when you put this in the acid bath, it doesn't etch underneath that tape. And I found that to be quite successful. I got some beautiful lines with that. K2KEY and 2MB.
KC2QIQ with a comment.
Before Barry, Barry, tell us what brand name is that tape and how expensive.
Okay, now I bought the tape. I used to buy the tape. I think I bought it at Radio Shack. And I also bought it from an outfit called KRP out in Long Island. I don't know where they are anymore, but I never knew the brand name. There's probably tapes you can buy not even intended for electrical use that would work too, but I'm not too sure of that. I think I've seen them, but I bought this stuff at KRP and Radio Shack. I don't think I ever got it anywhere else in 2MB.
Yeah, Eric just told us that KRP is now in Farmingdale. Wait for the beep, and Glenn, give us your comment on this.
Barry just brought to mind another quick and dirty way I've made, little circuits that were PC board-like. And what's interesting is that I used a tape called Kapton tape. It's a very, very high dielectric tape that's good to, 270 degrees C. So this tape doesn't melt with soldering iron, that's for sure. And they also sell a copper tape. So basically, if you have a piece of metal, like a piece of aluminum or something like that, and you want to build a circuit right on the aluminum, you can take 5mm Kapton tape, comes in multiple widths, and basically just lay the tape right over where you want to build your circuit, and then take the copper tape foil and just tape it over the top of the Kapton tape, and then just solder your components right to that. It's amazing how you can get away with building some power circuits or circuits that are, relatively low frequency, right onto a nice little sheet of aluminum or on the side of a case someplace, wherever you want to tuck a little circuit in on the side somewhere. But the company's called Kapton, and there's a website called KaptonTape.com for anybody who's really interested in trying something like that. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, the tape that comes as component shapes is manufactured by a company called Datak, D-A-T-A-K.
Okay, Datak. Also, Glenn, make a guess for me. If I had a roll of Kapton tape, which I've got sitting on the desk at the salt mine, and if I laid that onto the printed circuit board directly, cut it out with an X-Acto knife, do you believe that there's a chance that that would be a sufficiently good resist if I wanted to go to an etching process? What's your guess on that one, Glenn?
Well, you know what the killer is? I know that the Kapton tape is going to easily stand up to the etching chemical. I just don't think that the glue will. So as long as the glue can, you can maintain the integrity of the glue. Like I said, let's say the tape is wide enough, and then you put some kind of like etching on it, it might hold up. But you see the problem. It's the glue on the bottom of the tape that's going to be the issue.
Yes, I do. Eric, you might have some things you want to add to this. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Yeah, if you go back a bunch of years, just slipped my mind. Datak actually manufactured all the resist tapes and stuff that you could go directly to copper board. But the original products were for the draftsmen that made the 2 and 3 size, the bigger boards that would then photographically get reduced down to a negative, and that would be used for exposure to make the silk screen. They would silk screen the ink on when they would do mass productions of boards. You know what I'm talking about, Dick.
Yes, I do. There's an amazing number of ways of making printed circuit boards. Back to you, Mel, and Mel, give us a little bit more audio if you can.
Oh, there's one thing we left out.
Go ahead, Eric.
For those people that really have a need to make a board and don't have the desire to go through all that effort, there's a company called Sunstone Circuits. There's another one called PC Board 123. They supply you with the software to do your board layout. You hit the button, it sends the board layout to them. You send them $50 or $75, they send you back a board.
Yeah, there are a number of companies like that, like the one in Connecticut, in Canada, that I can't think of the name of right now, where you give them the equivalent of a Gerber file, and in a very short period of time, out comes a very nicely, professionally made, double-sided printed circuit board with plated through holes and all the grounding in the right place and whatever. Mail to you in about a day or two by overnight mail. A very successful process, so if you're willing to spend numbers like $50 or $100 to get a few printed circuit boards and have them very professionally done without going through all this learning curve, that's a way definitely worth considering. KE2EJ, here we go. K2KEY, with a little more audio. K2RAW, go ahead, Mel.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Well, we got off the subject by 14 miles again. This is for young people. Let's forget about the chemicals. Let's forget about all this $50 boards and all. Best suggestion I can give them is either use like I've used that simple with the X-Acto knife. You lay it out. If that way, if you have to make a little modification, you want to add another little component. You got a little room you leave on the board, you can scratch another little pad. That's the best thing. Or playing vector board. Vector board is very easy. You push the components in, you go on the other side, you wire it. This is it for starting out. Let's forget about all the chemicals that mommy will not like in a house, smelling up the house. And this grinding with the dust and all this stuff is just not for beginners. So I would like you to say, for beginners, yes, cutting the board simply with a hand tool, cutting, making it with a vector board, definitely. Now, the point is, I have another part of the question is, where do you purchase today small amounts of PC boards, one side copper clad, if you want to try, or vector board? Anybody know of a source? Over.
Correct me if I'm wrong, fellas.
I think small pieces of PC board, one-sided and two-sided, and vector board, at least a year ago, they were all in the bubble packs at Radio Shack. Am I wrong on that one? K2RIW on the TechNet.
See them no more.
Okay. Are you sure they've been removed from certain Radio Shacks or all Radio Shacks? Has anyone been in Radio Shack in the last few months and seen any printed circuit board or copper-clad board in those plastic packages hanging on the on little points of the dartboard, if you know what I mean, at Radio Shack? Has anyone seen those materials at Radio Shack? Give me a call that is right now.
KC2RFM. Quick comment here, too, N2MB.
Okay, Alan and Mel and Barry in that order. Go ahead, Alan.
Yes, they still have them. I just bought three vector boards from the Radio Shack on Central Avenue in Lawrence. There were plenty there. And they have the vector boards, and they have the boards that look like breadboards, but you can solder to them. I forget what those are called. And I use them all the time.
Very good news. Barry, go ahead.
KC2QIQ.
Wanted to add to that that if it's not in the Radio Shack store, very frequently it's in RadioShack.com. And a lot of stuff that's no longer in the store is still at RadioShack.com, so that's something to consider. N2MB.
I want to add one more thing, Dick.
Okay, Glenn and then Alan in that order. Glenn, go ahead.
Yeah, actually, Dick, there's a Radio Shack in Wausau, because not all the Radio Shacks are really the same. But there's one in Wausau on Sunrise Highway and Wausau Avenue that's actually pretty good. And I do believe they carry the vector boards, the little push pins, the little tool that allows you to, you know, to press the push pins in. And they do have some small sizes of the copper clad board as well. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, so I'm hearing the noise that Radio Shack still has the product if you go to the right Radio Shack or the Radio Shack website. Go ahead, Alan.
KC2RFN. I've done some electronics teaching. They're very basic electronics. And, you know, when you talk about the audience you're talking about, Mel probably isn't going to want to do much PC boards once they learn what's involved. And the truth is, if they're just working on basic circuits, the PC board, an etching PC board, is just a waste of time. And it's filthy and it's messy, and you really have to be into it to want to do it. What I am teaching my 8-year-old nephew to do is I got him the 130-in-1 kit with the little springs on it. Radio Shack used to sell them. They don't sell them anymore, but you can get them through Ramsey. And a great little kit, and you can do a lot of electronics with it, and it's not messy. No parents are going to mind it. And they can learn their electronics without wasting their time trying to make PC boards just for the sake of making PC boards. So, yeah, it's working great with my nephew, and, you know, it's good for anyone from 8 up to adult. I taught high school kids electronics on those kits. And to be honest, I check out circuits on those kits because it's so convenient. And it's even easier than the little breadboards where you got to stick the wires to the breadboards, and you can misalign them and all. The 130-in-1 kit is about $35, so very well worthwhile for people learning how to use electronics and do it no matter what their age is. Back to that.
Alan, where do you buy that kit?
I just bought a new one from Ramsey. It's in their catalog. They have a couple of them, and it's about $35.
Very good source. You got it, Mel.
That sounds good. Yes. Simple. Simple designs, that little other kits. Yeah, Radio Shack. I was to about 3 of them in the local area here, and I see that there's less and less there, and I was talking to a young lady I know in one of the places, and I said, what's going on here? She said, you know, they're dropping. I see you've got a lot of these parts cabinets, a lot of drawers are sparsely, you know, empty already. And I said, how come you don't keep up with the stock? She says, well, we filled out, you know, reports of what we have, and they don't seem to be too enthused about refilling, or seems like they're getting away bit by bit. It's like, let's put it this way. Radio Shack has changed drastically over the years, I mean, from the time of beginning, where now the parts are secondary because you see what their products are now, a lot of regular commercial products and all. And so I guess maybe if you go to Radio Shack, like you say, .com, maybe you could order it from that source. But you can get discouraged if you're going to regular Radio Shack. You don't find a lot of things that you used to see on the shelf, Dick, over.
WHCDL, I have some info.
Go right ahead, Andy.
I've been listening in, and good to see everybody today. Alan and Dick, and the list goes on, had a great time. Just want to mention, if you guys didn't know, my understanding is Radio Shack is not even called Radio Shack anymore. It is now called The Shack. And that's the new Radio Shack. So they got rid of the word radio. Has anyone seen that name besides myself? Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, a buddy of mine works for what used to be the Radio Shack in Matatuck on the North Fork, and he keeps calling it The Shack, and I thought he was just using that as a slang. I think you're saying that might be the official name. Andy, roughly how long ago do you think they switched over to that name? And what do you think is the reason they felt a need to switch over? Go ahead, Andy.
I'm laughing to myself, but I'm thinking maybe it's because they're not selling radios anymore. Well, like Mel said, they went to the consumer product line more so than ever before. And remember when they sold amateur equipment? And then they went out of that line, and then there was a rumor they were going to come back, but I don't think they ever did. In fact, I own and have a few Radio Shack HTX202s, which are great little handhelds. In fact, I use one in the bunny box that we use. So I don't know how long ago they changed their name. I would say within the year. But I know that they're really pressing hard, especially in the cellular phone business, and they're doing a lot of that now, more so. And that's maybe the reason why they changed the name, I'm not sure. Okay, back to you. Anything else? I've done a lot of PC board work also, and I can tell you I just did a very intricate repair on a PC board that had a broken land, and that was a job.
I'm guessing you use signal tracing techniques to find where there was a hair crack in a land and contact wasn't being made, and once you found it, to clean the board and solder over the crack is a possible solution, or to solder a conducting material over the crack. Is that approximately what you did, Andy? Go ahead.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't that easy. The land that was broken, and I know I jumped around a bit by mentioning, you know, repairing PC boards because that's another art in itself. There was a 100-pin fine pitch integrated circuit, flat pack IC, with little teeny tiny LANs going to each side of the IC. There's 25 LANs, 25 pins, and 25 LANs per side. Two of the LANs were accidentally damaged and were not making connection to the pin of the IC. So what I needed to do was physically extend the LAN outwards, because it was, again, accidentally pulled up away from the pin of the IC. So there was actually no connection at all, and you could plainly see it. So the first step was to actually remove that flat pack IC to get underneath it where the land was broken. Let me let it drop. And I did this, by the way, with the naked eye, and just a jeweler's loop, a very steady hand, and a bright light. No microscope on this one. After removing the IC, I needed to extend this land, and I don't know exactly the width of the land in micrometers, because it was that small, you can hardly see it.
In fact, maybe you can just give me a number, because I don't know, or maybe Glenn knows the number, on a flat pack 100 pin IC. What is the actual width of those LANs going?